Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everybody. I guess good afternoon on this snowy, cold wintry day in New York City. Seth Kamens, normally the host of the Seth and Sean radio show on Tuesday nights on Blog Talk Radio. This afternoon, we have kind of a different kind of podcast. I decided, in my infinite wisdom a couple weeks ago, to have the two smartest people I know when it comes to the sporting world debate Hall of Fame, potential Hall of Fame candidates in the four major sports, basketball, baseball, football, hockey. I will introduce them now, actually. My co-host on the Seth and Sean radio show, Mr. Sean Palmer.
Good morning, everybody.
Wow, that was an exciting response, to say the least.
I'm just queuing it all up. I'm holding it back, waiting to go. It's 12 o'clock on a Saturday morning or Saturday afternoon. We got lots of football to talk about later in the week, but this is the Hall of Fame show. I'm ready to go. Let's go, Nabate. Let's go.
All right.
And his opponent. And, yes, I actually kind of say opponent or his debating, whatever you want to call it. Host of so much to talk about on Manhattan News Network. Producer for NBA for Sirius Radio for the NBA Sirius Radio Network. Twice beating the Schwab on Stump the Schwab on ESPN, Mr. Nabate Isles.
Thank you. Actually, I only beat the Schwab once. You know, definitely. Like, I wish I had a rematch with him just to do it again. But you know, it didn't happen like that. But thank you for having me on, Sean. I look forward to hearing your reasoning for certain things. You know, I don't know what it is about, but you know, we shall see.
to quickly go over the rules of this, as opposed to a yelling contest, so we don't end up like we're on one of the shows, like not like PTI or Around the Horn. We're actually going to have this in a relatively civilized way. I sent out 40 names to Nabate and to Sean. They emailed me back their choices, yes in the Hall of Fame, not in the Hall of Fame. Until 15 minutes ago, they did not know who was going to be on the list for the show. There were 20 people, actually, out of the 40 they disagreed on. We have 11 that we have on the show. Each person who was a proponent of someone being in the Hall of Fame will have 2 minutes to say why. Then there will be a two-minute response, 30-second rebuttal, 30-second rebuttal. So, you guys ready to get rolling?
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, let's do this.
Okay. We are going to start off with football. And I will start off with the great wide receiver from the Pittsburgh Steelers, from the University of Georgia, Dancing with the Stars, now an NBC, I believe, football analyst, or he's kind of playing around a little bit. Mr. Hines Ward. And Nabate, you have 2 minutes. You were in favor of him?
Yes, I am.
The show is yours.
All right. Well, Hines Ward, coming out of University of Georgia, was a quarterback there. Great athlete. Great leader, exemplary leader. He exemplified the Pittsburgh Steelers of toughness, of accountability, being accountable, of being a leader of his team. And I got to say, 1,000 career receptions, consistency throughout the years. I mean, when you look at the 2000 decade, he started off the decade 48 catches, then 94 catches, 112, 95, 80, 69, 74, 71, 81, 95. That was throughout the entire decade. He was the motto of consistency, and he was healthy, he was durable throughout. And like I said, 1,000 career receptions, 85 career touchdown receptions. He was incredible in Super Bowl 2005 Super Bowl, which was the Super Bowl when Pittsburgh defeated the Seattle Seahawks. And it was not the Ben Roethlisberger show. Roethlisberger was a young second-year quarterback who definitely struggled in that game, and Hines Ward was pretty much his security blanket to make Ben Roethlisberger the player he is today. Hines Ward was instrumental in that, and Hines Ward, like I said, when it comes to consistency overall and being able to play for a long period of time at a high level, and one of the great blocking wide receivers in the history of the game, very physical. As you saw, there were some questionable hits that he put on linebackers and safeties and corners. He definitely was hated around the NFL, you know, other than fans of Pittsburgh and his teammates, but he was respected at the end of the day. And Hines Ward played the game the right way, and like I said, 1,000 career catches overall in his career, ninth in the NFL, one of nine receivers to have 1,000 career catches, and like I said, consistency, and he did all the little things right for the Pittsburgh Steelers. So I don't see him as a first ballot Hall of Famer. He's not first ballot, but I do see him to get in eventually. I say around the third or fourth year of eligibility for him. So Hines Ward is a Hall of Famer.
Sean, your response.
Well, the way that I love to do Hall of Fames is comparisons with people in the general vicinity of when these guys played. So, yes, you are absolutely right. Hines Ward was a model of consistency. No question. This may be one of the few times I agree with Nabatha House, but yes, an absolute model of consistency. He was a great blocker, no doubt. He had one great Super Bowl. Fantastic. He was a leader. How you define leader is beyond me, but he was a leader of the Pittsburgh Steelers, along with DeMontre Dawson and a whole lot of other people, of which none of which would probably make the Hall of Fame. So, let's go on to the contemporaries, and that's the way that I judge a Hall of Famer, is whether he was the best of his era, whether he was statistically the best of his era. And three of the guys that really played in his era that go right along with his supposed milestones are Keenan McCardle, who nobody would say is the best player on his team with Jimmy Smith, definitely wouldn't be a Hall of Famer. Derek Mason, yeah, he's the number one wide receiver on those Houston and Tennessee Titans. And then Isaac Bruce. So Isaac Bruce, 16 seasons, 1,024 yards. Hines Ward, 14 seasons, 1,024 receptions. Hines Ward, 14 seasons, 217 games, 1,000 receptions. So six games difference, 24 receptions. Isaac Bruce, 3,000 more yards, six more receiving touchdowns, the same amount of Pro Bowls, and no first-team All-Pros.
15 seconds.
Hines Ward, not exactly the great player, he was a good player. Tony Hull would have been the best player on those Rams teams. Hines Ward, if you put him on any other team, not the best player on his team. He's not the best player on his team. He's not in the Hall of Fame.
Nabatha, 30-second response. Go.
Okay, just want to correct you. That's DeMontre Dawson, by the way. Just want to correct you on the pronunciation of DeMontre Dawson. And DeMontre Dawson also played in the 90s as well. So they overlapped kind of, you know, him and Hines Ward. But anyway, Isaac Bruce was part of an explosive offense with Kurt Warner, Marshall Faulk, Torrey Holt. All that, you know, I mean, Hines Ward was the guy for many years. He was the best receiver. There was no one else with him, so a lot of defensive attention was on Hines Ward, and still he was able to be that possession receiver, that guy that you can depend on. And as a leader, the Pittsburgh Steelers were consistently winning every single year with Hines Ward.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Sean, 30 seconds.
You're absolutely right. He was a possession receiver. That's two, by the way. Absolutely right. He's a possession receiver. Absolutely right that he had more attention. Absolutely right. He got every ball that was thrown. So that's it. Yeah, he had more chances.
Okay. Going on to the next player. The first truly great special teams player, or someone really distinguished as a special teams player, many-time All-Pro, I believe, from the Buffalo Bills, Steve Tasker. Sean, you were in favor? And I'll stop you guys. I'll tell you guys at 1 minute and at 30 seconds. Sean, it's yours.
Well, it's funny that you said he's the greatest of all time, because that's absolutely correct. Steve Tasker is the greatest special teamer of all time. And when you're the greatest of all time, and unanimously spoken of as the greatest of all time, there's only one place for you to be, and that's in the Hall of Fame. You can't be the best of all time and not be in the Hall of Fame. Jan Stenerud, who is the only other special teamer in the Hall of Fame, was the greatest kicker of all time right now. I mean, you have other guys like Justin Tucker that may take over. But as of today, he's the greatest of all time. Steve Tasker is the greatest of all time. There were teams that game planned for a special teamer. The concept of that is unheard of. It was unheard of. He made I think he made 10 or more Pro Bowls. He was a guy on those Buffalo Bills teams that you game plan for. He changed games. He was the definition of special team All-Pro. The problem with special teamers is that you don't have statistics to back him up. So you can't point out the amount of tackles because he had two guys on him at all times. And he still made those plays. When you think of the Buffalo Bills in the 1990s, know they didn't win a Super Bowl. I wonder if they did if they'd have more players in the Hall of Fame. I'm done. It's just that simple an argument.
Nabate, your response.
Okay, a lot of respect for Steve Tasker, no doubt about it. But why was he in special teams? Because he couldn't cut it as a wide receiver. He couldn't cut it at all. And that's the thing. I think special teamers are athletes that cannot cut it at their position that they were drafted for. So that's the thing with Steve Tasker. Now, any great athlete could be – now, Steve Tasker did make 7 Pro Bowls, yes. He was 7-time All-Pro, okay, for special teams, okay. And yes, there was game planning against him. But like I said, it's someone with, like, special teams. Anybody can be a great special teams player. And Tasker also, it was the beginning of the time that special teams, individual special team players were being recognized. So, of course, he's going to be recognized if he was great in the beginning. Of course, he was going to be recognized over and over and over again because he was, he definitely set the trend. But at the same time, though, he did not excel at a position. I feel as a Hall of Famer, and I think Tasker does deserve to be a semifinalist, but as a Hall of Famer, you should excel at a position on offense or defense, because the special teams, you do have the help of other people around you. But when you're playing your position, you are exposed much more, and your greatness is magnified much more. So as I said before, Tasker to me is not a Hall of Famer.
Interesting response. Sean, 30 seconds.
Okay, there are players that change position all the time from wide receiver to running back and so forth, so I don't think that necessarily precludes the fact that he changed his position and maybe he just went in as a special teamer or a relief pitcher when we get to the baseball. But the fact is he was the best of all time in a position that is on the football field. When you're the best of all time, you deserve to be in the Hall of Fame.
Nabate, last word.
But as I said before with Tasker, though, the problem is, though, with special teams, you have the help, actually. It's more of a scheme. It's more of a scheme overall for personnel, like an overall personnel, overall team, than it is for an individual. So that's why he's not a Hall of Famer to me. I don't know if I explained that good. I don't know if you guys got that.
But you only got 30 seconds as a response, so I completely understand. One of the tougher, in my mind, players to choose off of this list. Running back, University of Georgia, MVP, helped lead Denver to 2 championships. And then, unfortunately, due to injuries, really only had a 6-year career. The great Terrell Davis, who I think both sides agree would have been a Hall of Famer without question if he played another 4, 5, 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
Terrell, so Nabate, the floor is yours.
Oh, I thought yes.
Oh, no, the floor is mine.
I'm sorry. My fault. My fault. Sean, the debate, the floor is yours.
Okay. Now, football, and as we see, I'll make a different argument in baseball. I think football, when you get to dominance, it can be a shorter period of time. You can have 4 or 5 or 6 seasons of dominance and make the Hall of Fame due to the injury problems that happen in football rather than baseball or basketball. And this is a prime example of that. Terrell Davis played at an elite level. He averaged 4.6 yards per carry for his career, 7,000 yards. I mean, dominant in the regular season. He won the league MVP in 1998. He ran for 2,000 yards. Unbelievable. Made the Super Bowl, won 2 Super Bowls with John Elway. He was not the MVP. I'm sorry. I thought he was. He averaged during those Super Bowl seasons 5.12 and 4.74 yards per carry, which are ridiculous numbers today. I mean, the only guy that's even close to that these days is Jamaal Charles and LeSean McCoy, just to put that in perspective. He played at an elite level for 4 years, played just 17 games in his last 3, and that's a problem. I mean, I understand when you're talking, he's along the lines of Terry Allen in yards for his entire career, but I say look at the opposite. Look at guy like Gale Sayers, who played seven seasons and only 68 games. There's a first-team All-Famer. Now, I understand what Nabati is saying, that Steve Tasco deserves to be a semifinalist, and Hines Ward may not be first-team Hall of Famer. In my mind, there is no first-year Hall of Famer. In my mind, there's either you are in or you're out. Terrell Davis, like Gale Sayers, should be in.
Nabati?
Well, Gale Sayers revolutionized the running back position. He was a touchdown waiting to happen any single time he touched a ball as a returner or receiver out of the backfield or straight out, or you know, getting the handoff from the backfield. So there is no comparison. Gale Sayers was an amazing player, and he was dangerous. Terrell Davis was a very good running back in an excellent system, the zone blocking system. Check out the people that got 1,000 yards after Terrell Davis left, after his injuries, which were unfortunate. Class act, no question, unfortunate that his injuries happened. Olindis Gary, Neil Anderson, Clinton Portis, Reuben Drones, all those guys were 1,000-yard rushers after Terrell Davis got injured. Those guys were able, in the zone blocking system, were able to excel. And I think overall I thought Clinton Portis was the most talented running back of those guys. Terrell second when it comes to talent. Clinton Portis is more talented. But Davis in the right system, as well as having receivers like Easy Ed McCaffrey and Rod Smith, in an offensive line that had Tom Nalen, guys like that, you know, like talent around him, and also that zone blocking system, that's what made Terrell Davis excel. Now, Terrell Davis, the injuries, he just did not sustain enough of a career. He had three great seasons and a good rookie season, but he just did not sustain enough for him to be a Hall of Famer. And then you saw, as I mentioned, all those running backs having success after Terrell Davis, after the injury struck him. So, like I said, he's, and also another guy that had a shortened career was Earl Campbell. Earl Campbell revolutionized the game. Earl Campbell was the only option on that Houston Oilers team, and he became that great of a player, you know, in his rookie year, 1,800 yards. So Earl Campbell, Gale Sayers, at another level compared to what Terrell Davis was. When you look at the film, just look at the film of those three running backs.
Sean?
So according to Nabate, no player on any really, really good team should be in the Hall of Fame because they have all this other talent around them. That's a different story. No Dallas Cowboys in the 90s should be in the Hall of Fame because they have a whole lot of talent. But that's okay. A running back has rushed for 1,750 yards 26 times. Terrell Davis has done it once. Reuben Jones has never done it. Mike Anderson has never done it. Olindis Gary has never done it. Davis did it twice. He and Emmitt Smith are the only players to win a Super Bowl in the season that they did. That's it.
Devontae, last word.
But if the running game suffered after Terrell Davis suffered those injuries, then Terrell Davis, bona fide Hall of Famer. The running game kept going after Terrell Davis. They still were effective. They still had 1,000-plus yard rushers. And Clinton Portis, in his first two seasons, was magnificent under that same system.
That was a damn good debate, guys. Okay, last football player that I've chosen. And for those of you who are listening, of the 10 guys I gave, seven, there were disagreements on seven of them. This player, Heisman Trophy winner at Notre Dame, great receiver for one team, for the Raiders for 10, 12, 14 years, never won a Super Bowl, but really considered both a great punt returner and a great receiver. Tim Brown. Nabate?
Okay, Tim Brown. I mean, what can you say about him? In the 90s, one of the most dominant, most explosive players. He was an excellent return man for the Raiders, and also, too, he was the only – he pretty much exemplified speed kills, you know? And Tim Brown showed the skills that he wasn't just a speedster. There were a lot of other Raider receivers that played with Tim Brown, like James Jett, guys like that, that did not have the skill set as Tim Brown. Tim Brown did not just rely on his speed. He relied on improved route running skills. He relied on improved technique at the wide receiver position. And when you look at a period of time starting from 1993, 80 catches, 89 catches, 89, 90, 104, 81, 90, 76, 90. That's within a 9-year span of Tim Brown. And also, too, 9 straight 1,000-yard seasons for Timmy Brown. And remember, he was really the only reliant receiver on that Oakland Raiders team that didn't have great quarterbacks also. Jeff Hostetler, very good quarterback, not great. Jeff George, great talent, not a good quarterback. You know, more of a 10 you know, physical traits, but not much of a brain. So Timmy Brown had consistency through this time where quarterbacks were switching for the Oakland Raiders, and also another thing, too, 9 Pro Bowl appearances as well, his first in 88, his last in 2001. And he also, as well, made the all-NFL team in 1992. So in 1990, he was one of the best receivers, along with Jerry Rice and Chris Carter. Timmy Brown was sensational, and you measure his numbers up to anybody, anybody in any era.
Okay.
So Tim Brown's a bona fide Hall of Famer.
Sean?
The problem with the wide receivers is that we're getting into the age, even in the 90s, of lots of catches, lots of receptions, lots of yards. It's that simple. And, you go against his contemporaries. Was he one of the best? Yes. You have absolutely no argument with me, Devontae, that Tim Brown was one of the best. And when you add in the Heisman Trophy, definitely one of the best. No question. But he wasn't in the elite. Guys like Keenan, I'll go back to the same concept of guys like Keenan McCardle and Rod Smith. And I understand the concept of the quarterback and the fact that Tim Brown didn't have the greatest of quarterbacks. I get it. So guys like 85 catches in 96, 85 catches, 64, 78, 94, 93, 61, 84. That's Keenan McCardle. Okay? And I understand that he had Jimmy Smith on some of those and not on others. I get it. But you said it perfectly. He was a model of consistency. He wasn't a model of dominance. And when you need a Hall of Famer, you need dominance. I don't care if it's a small part or a big part of his career. You need at least a short term of dominance. And Tim Brown didn't dominate at any time. He was a good to great receiver. Good to great. Was not great the whole entire career. Wasn't even great for a little bit. He didn't. I don't believe he ever led the league in catches. I don't believe he ever led the league in yards. And until you do that, at least once. And it's the same thing with Hines Ward. You're not in the Hall of Fame today. It's just that simple.
Nabate, 30 seconds.
Actually, Timmy Brown did lead the league in catches in 1997. He had 104 catches. And also, too, Timmy Brown was one of the wide receivers that made the all-90s team along with Jerry Rice, Chris Carter, and Michael Irvin. And like I said before, Tim Brown was the only option in that team, on that team for a long time. And, you know, opposing defensive coordinators couldn't stop him from his consistency and from his explosiveness as well.
Sean, last word.
Okay, so we're looking at defensive coordinators trying to stop him, and yet you just argued on Terrell Davis where they couldn't stop him. But, okay, I get that. The concept being that he might have led for 1 year, and you're right. I didn't pick up on that. Absolutely correct. And to say that he was part of the 1990s All-Pro team, that's cherry-picking 10 years. I just don't get it. Jack Morris should be in the Hall of Fame that way, and I don't believe he is either.
Well, now we'll get to baseball in a little while. And I do apologize for our listeners. I probably should have gone away from another wideout. There are other players that were disagreed upon, including Aeneas Williams and Ray Guy. So if we do a sequel show, we'll go in that direction. Want to jump to basketball. And actually, these guys agreed on most of the basketball players because I think the basketball, to be perfectly honest, is the easiest Hall of Fame to get into. One that they didn't agree on was the center, was a longtime center for the Seattle Supersonics and Milwaukee Bucks. Great shooter, terrible perm, bit of a drug habit. Jack Sikma. Nabate, you were in favor of him? It's yours.
Yes, Jack Sikma, to me, one of the most underrated players in the NBA from the standpoint of his touch around the basket, his skill set in posting up. And another thing with Jack Sikma, He helped win a championship in 1979 with the Seattle Supersonics, where he averaged a double-double, 16 and 12, and in the playoffs, averaged a double-double as well for that team. So that was in his second year in the NBA. What makes me impressed about Jack Sigma is his amazing free throw percentage as a 7-footer. He led the league, the only center ever to lead the league in free throw percentage in the 87-88 season, 92%, had an 85% free throw percentage overall. But that shows his versatility. Defensively, he was able to really make an impact overall for his teams. He made 7 straight All-Star appearances from 79 to 85 with Seattle, and then with the Seattle Supersonics, and then with the Milwaukee. Actually, it was all with Seattle, and with Milwaukee, he was more of a veteran there. But Sigma overall just exemplified a lot of versatility as a center, and his skill set was incredible. And the fact is, imagine if he was able to play on a team like the Boston Celtics, a la Robert Parrish and a la Kevin McHale. I think he would have been able to do the same thing that those guys did in winning championships with Larry Bird. So Jack Sigma, just a model of consistency, and also just his shooting touch, where no centers don't have that touch today. He was very unique for his time.
Sean?
Yeah, I was totally confused. If you're on a good team, you can't make the Hall of Fame because you're on a good team, but if you're on a bad team, you would make the Hall of Fame if you're on the good team. I just don't get this whole rationale of good team versus bad team. But okay, so Jack Sigma.
Okay, so we're going to debate that too then.
He was on the second team all-defensive team once. He never won a weekly, a monthly, or he never made an all-NBA team. Not at all. Not in his entire career. I love Jack Sigma. He was one of the guys I played on the NBA Jam with. I loved him. 1978, 1977, 1978, NBA All-Rookie Team. Yeah, he did that. And then 81-82 All-Defensive Team. He did that. He won one championship. The comps, and I understand we deal with comps. His best comp in his generation is Bill Laimbeer. Bill Laimbeer's not a Hall of Famer at all. Not even close. You wouldn't put him on the ballot, let alone in the Hall of Fame, unless you were getting the boxing ring. He's not going to do it. Defensive rebounding, yeah, he was a good defensive rebounder. In fact, he was first 2 years, two years. He was a great shooter. He had good touch. He was a good free thrower, like Mark Price. Just because you're good at free throws doesn't make you a Hall of Famer. You have to have a fully rounded game, and he was a very good player. All these players that we discussed are very good players. That's why they bring up debate. But they're not Hall of Famers. I'll go with Seth Kamen's definition of Hall of Famer. He's in the Hall of very good. He's not a great player. If he was a great player, he would have been on an All-NBA team once in his career, and he wasn't.
I love being quoted on my radio show, and and yes, I am a big believer in the Hall of very good. Not the Hall of Fame. People are in the Hall of very good, not in the Hall of Fame, or should not be in the Hall of Fame. Nabate, 30-second response.
Now, you compare him to statistically, like being compared with Laimbeer, but he's also compared with Robert Parrish, Dikembe Mutombo, Wes Unseld, Bob Lanier. Those guys are Hall of Famers. Like Mutombo is, that's another, I have to think about him, but that's another show. But Unseld, Lanier, Parrish are Hall of Famers. So Parrish became a Hall of Famer. What did Robert Parrish do outside? You know, and Laimbeer played with the great Pistons team, of course. But anyway, like I said, with Sigma, it wasn't just about free throws. Have you seen Sigma play? Have you actually seen him play? Did you see the things he did on the court?
Nabate, time up. Sean, you can respond.
All right. Well, Mutombo wasn't his contemporary, and I believe I said contemporaries. Parrish, I'm not sure, belongs in the Hall of Fame if he didn't have 5 championships. And Unseld, you're right. But Unseld made a couple of Hall, and Lanier was well before him in the early 70s.
Unseld, you said contemporaries. Okay, I didn't hear you.
Unseld made a couple of All-NBA teams. He made a couple of All-Defensive teams. And Sigma has none of that. So if his contemporaries aren't voting him in at that point, why should I be any different and look back and say he was much better than he was? He just wasn't.
All right.
But I asked you, did you see him play? That's why I asked you. Like, did you see any of his films? Game films?
Okay. Going forward.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
The only other player that was disagreed on also was was actually, to me, the toughest person on the list. Guard for the Milwaukee Bucks as well for the most of his career. Stud at Arkansas, one of the best defensive guards of all time. Really, to me, a borderline Hall of Famer, Mr. Sidney Moncrief. Once again, Nabate, floor is yours.
All right. Well, Sidney Moncrief, the reason why he's in the Hall of Fame, if the Hall of Fame did not include college career, then it would be a little tougher to put him in, just a little tougher. But at Arkansas, he was exemplary. He was the All-America in 1978-79 season. 78, he led them to the Final Four. And he was one of the best college players of the decade of the 70s. He comes into the NBA. He's a four-time all-defensive player. He's also makes all-NBA team one time in his career as well. And he was a two-time NBA defensive player of the year. Now, you look at Dennis Rodman, who was just known for his defense and rebounding. But when you look at Sidney Moncrief, he was able to be a good two-way, an excellent two-way player, someone that can stop you on the defensive end and someone that can score points on the offensive end. He was a good offensive player. He wasn't much of a jump shooter, but he was able to create his shot with his athleticism. And then, of course, he was the lockdown guy that would lock you down on the ball defensively. So he really made an impact, especially on those Milwaukee Bucks teams that ran into the Boston Celtics, unfortunately. They were the cogs in them getting into the NBA Finals. But he was able to be that defender for Don Nelson and also provide fast-paced offense. So he was a very versatile player. And like I said, his college career, he was exceptional in his college career. And you look at people like Jamal Wilkes in the Hall of Fame and Ralph Sampson in the Hall of Fame. Those guys in the Hall of Fame didn't have the longevity or the consistency that Sidney Moncrief had. So you got to put him in the Hall of Fame based on both his college career and his pro career and being one of the most versatile players in the NBA of his time.
Who would ever think that you'd put Don Nelson in defense in the same sentence? Sean, you're up next.
That's what's crazy. Like, yeah. He defensive clog for Don. Mm-hmm.
Sidney Moncrief, and we'll get to the other one when we get to baseball, where these were the two hardest omissions for me. And I agree with Nabate in that he was good at just about everything. And he was a pretty great defender, but he was pretty good at just about everything. And the inclusion of his All-American career, I agree, that does add some weight. But when you add him to guys like Ralph Sampson, who was the two-time Player of the Year, that's dominance. That's not great. That's not even good. That's complete and utter. Ralph Sampson was a dominant player at Virginia. Sidney Moncrief was a very good player at Arkansas. He was an All-American, sure. So was Doug McDermott, but he's not going to get in because of his play at Creighton either. Just saying that there's difference is between dominance and greatness. And for me, it's dominance in the Hall of Fame. Sidney Moncrief is really close to me, absolutely close. And what gets me is that he only played five All-Star games, which is less than Jack Sikma. Small total for a Hall of Famer, especially when you're comparing him to his contemporaries. He never played for an NBA champ, and I understand this falls right into the Nabate Isles argument of you need good players to win championships, and thus that makes you good, but it doesn't mean that you can play on good championships because that detracts you. His traditional per-game statistics, points, rebounds, and assists, not great. And I understand that in today's society, you can underrate those. So 16 points, about 16 points a game, 5 assists. Defensively, he was a master. Absolutely the greatest, probably the greatest defensive player of that generation. I give you that. But overall, I just think he is good at just about everything, but not great at anything.
Nabate, 30 seconds.
But also you look at his playoff background as well. Well, first of all, what I'm saying about having talent around you, meaning what happens when you leave? That's what I'm saying. If things keep going, then that's it. What happened in Milwaukee after Sidney Moncrief left, after he started to fade? What happened to the Bucks? Were they significant?
Is this an actual question?
No, that's the end of my
okay.
But Navante, that also depends very highly on who's replacing him. That's not a fair question at all. If you have guys who replace him with the same amount of talent, I don't care who you are. If you have Clinton Portis that replaced Terrell Davis, Clinton Portis had just as much talent as Terrell Davis. Okay, so you sub him in, he does the same thing. There could be back-to-back Hall of Famers. They happen in every single sport. When Bill Dickey retired and Yogi Berra took over, he didn't have any detraction. Did that make it any less that Bill Dickey was a Hall of Famer? I think not.
5 seconds. Okay.
Bill Dickey took over for Yogi Berra, you said?
No, Yogi Berra replaced Bill Dickey.
Bill Dickey
no,
there
was
way
a,
before.
There was a, no, there was a, ten, there was a, there was a,
there was a, there was, a, there was about 10 years of time lag, but I'm saying when you have
we're talking about replacing, but Clinton Portis replacing Terrell Davis, that was only a few years, like maybe 3-4 seasons. That's a big difference between a decade.
You want me to come up with Hall of Famers that replaced Hall of Famers?
All right,
really?
Okay, guys. This is, guys.
No, I'm, guys, no guys. I'm just saying. I'm piggybacking. I'm just saying, if you're going to talk about someone replacing someone, then be accurate about replacing.
Navante, you know? Collier Shrumpke was 1 year after Ted Williams. Okay? No detraction. Nothing. Does that
mean
Ted
Williams
is 43
years old and fading? Come on now.
So okay. Now you're catering the argument to you. Got it.
Guys,
okay, go ahead.
I'm actually saying that. Okay. On to one of the toughest. We're going on to baseball and one of the toughest debates really you have is Shoeless Joe Jackson. You know, obviously a Hall of Fame player, considered part of the Black Sox scandal of 1919, although he did hit, I believe, 375 in the 1919 World Series against Cincinnati. Sean, you're in favor of it. It's all yours.
Yeah, I'm totally in favor of him because this basically depends on whether you believe that he should be banned from baseball. And if whether his actions off the field counteract what he did on the field. Jackson's involvement in the fix, he batted 375. He hit the only series home run. He threw out five base runners. No errors. 5 times that Jackson came to the plate with a man in scoring position, and he advanced those runners twice, one of them scoring. Unless you are so biased against this team that you feel that because of the fix, they should be out of the Hall of Fame, there's no reason statistically that Joe Jackson should not be in the Hall of Fame. Joe Jackson was probably the first or second best hitter of the first 30 years of baseball, from 1900 to 1930. You got Ty Cobb, that's it. And Babe Ruth was later. He retired, I believe, in 37. So there's no statistical concept where Joe Jackson is out of the Hall of Fame. I have a feeling that Mr. Iles feels because of either the shortness of his time or the fact that he was banned from baseball, he should be out of the Hall of Fame. And if that's his belief, then there's no counter-argument. That's his belief, and we're done. So let's hear what he thinks.
Now, just to say this about the shortness of his career, there's no question. I'm a baseball historian. There's no question Shoeless Joe Jackson is one of the great players of all time. But he was involved in a scandal when you are throwing games in a championship format. There's no excuse for that. I'm sorry. He was part of that, and that's the reason why he's left out of the Hall of Fame forever, and it should continue like that. But as a baseball player, what he's done, I know all about Shoeless Joe Jackson's numbers. I don't need to go through that. So, but at the end of the day, he was part of that scandal. At the end of the day, he was banned from baseball. And if Pete Rose is banned, then Shoeless Joe Jackson should be banned too, forever.
Okay. Do we need a rebuttal on this, or this is so straightforward that we can just kind of go to the next player?
Well, I think the only rebuttal is I believe that Pete Rose should be in the Hall of Fame too. So maybe we both agree on that. There's no rebuttal because we both agree. It's just a matter of preference.
Okay, one which we will. The next player is actually one of the bigger debates, And the only player that both Nabate and Sean knew was going to be part of this, because actually the discussion of Roy Halladay started really the idea of having this podcast. Halladay, a great pitcher for Toronto and for Philly, won a couple of Cy Youngs, threw a perfect game, threw a no-hitter, considered one of the best pitchers of a good 10-year span. Nabate is in favor.
Mm-hmm.
Argue, Mr. Halladay.
All right. Now, Sean talks about dominance, right, being in the Hall of Fame. That's what Roy Halladay exemplified, dominance. He won two Cy Youngs, was a runner-up for two other Cy Young Awards, and a third-place finisher for another Cy Young. He could have won five Cy Young Awards, actually, in both leagues. Roy Halladay also, as well, was an All-Star eight times, also two regarded one of the best pitchers in the 2000 decade, arguably the best pitcher when you from the standpoint of, well, one of the top three, because you have Randy Johnson as well as Pedro Martinez and also Clemens too. But Roy Halladay dominated, and in fact, another thing with Roy Halladay which was very interesting was that Halladay, he had a terrible start to his career, and he was able to go down in the minors to single A and alter his mechanics for him to be able to come back and be the dominant pitcher that he became. Roy Halladay, as I mentioned before, a two-time Cy Young Award winner, could have won five Cy Youngs. He was a top three guy in three other years, and was able to pitch a perfect game and a no-hitter the same season, a no-hitter in the playoffs as well. So Halladay, to me, is a Hall of Famer for sure. Now, I don't know about first ballot, but he is a definite Hall of Famer, eventually a Hall of Famer for sure. And when he made the playoffs, he had a 2.37 ERA, 0.737 WHIP. He unfortunately only had five starts in the playoffs, but he was dominant in those appearances for Philadelphia because he was on a terrible Toronto team for those years.
By far the hardest omission that I've made in this entire thing. And granted, that's why we have 5 years. That's why the baseball writers have 5 years to make this decision. Right now, I'm on the cusp of no. And I agree with you, Nabate. He was dominant. He was for 5 years, five, six, 7 years. Absolutely agree. No question about it. But as I said before, I believe baseball is a little bit different than the rest of the sports in regards to injuries and whatnot. The fact that he has a great story behind it, that helps. No question about it. But if you look at his total statistics, and I take the whole entire painting as a whole, him and Tim Hudson are no different. Now, do they have the different awards? Yeah. Tim Hudson won 20 games with the A's. Could he have won a Cy Young? Sure. Could he have won two? Perhaps. And that's not to degrade Roy Halladay or Tim Hudson. They both had great careers. And, in fact, for the 7 years that you stated, he was dominant.
Wait a minute.
But when you make dominance in pitching for 7 years, and you base that, your entire Hall of Fame argument, on 7 years, you better be Koufaxian. And I use that as an adjective. Sandy Koufax was dominant. Sandy Koufax was averaging, I have it here somewhere, his adjusted ERA was 1.56. He did it in 2,300 innings, and how they did it in 2,700 innings. I don't doubt for a minute that Halladay was dominant for those five or six seasons, and you made the point absolutely correctly that he could have won five Cy Youngs. So could a lot of pitchers, but he could have won five Cy Youngs, and I agree with you. And in 5 years, I may change. In fact, in 2 years, I may change. But the fact is, because he retired this is so closely, this is very much an immediate reaction. So that's why they give 5 years. I may come around to your line of thinking. It's possible. But then I have to find a way to look at those numbers and not see Tim Hudson. And that's my problem right now.
Nabate, 30 seconds.
Now, Tim Hudson, did he ever strike out? Did he ever have any seasons of over 200 strikeouts? Roy Halladay had five seasons of over 200 strikeouts. Tim Hudson was not as overpowering as Roy Halladay, especially later in his career when Halladay struck out 200 hitters in four straight seasons, two in Toronto, then two in Philadelphia with another team. So Halladay got stronger as his career went on. That's what made him dominant throughout his career. Won his first Cy Young in 2003,
okay.
Won his 30, second
only
Cy
got,
Young
only
in
got 30 seconds. Only got 30 seconds, Devontae.
Mm-hmm.
Sean, 30-second response.
Mm-hmm.
No, I totally understand what you're saying. And the fact is, maybe if Hudson had played on some better teams, he would have won a couple of more Cy Youngs. But the fact is, he didn't. And that's just the way it works. Tim Hudson had three top five Cy Youngs. So and he did not win any. And to answer your question, I'm looking at the strikeouts. He did not at any point strike out over 200 batters.
Okay.
Yes, he did. Roy Halladay did strike out 200 batters in five.
No, he said Tim Hudson.
Oh, Tim Hudson. Oh, okay.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, yeah.
I was answering your question.
But,
okay.
But also, too,
onto,
another thing, Tim Hudson's had – okay, sorry. All right.
On to another big, real tough debate, tough choice. In my mind, the second best leadoff hitter of all time, batting champion, seven-time All-Star, 700-some-odd stolen base – 800 stolen bases. Tim Raines. Sean, I know where you stand on this. Go to town.
Yeah, there is no player that deserves to be in the Hall of Fame right now more than Tim Raines. In any Hall of Fame. Tim Raines was the second-best leadoff hitter, not of his generation, which is true, but of all time. And the only reason that this man is not in the Hall of Fame is because Ricky Henderson was so dominant. It is unbelievable how a guy in a five-year stretch, and we talk about dominance, five-year stretch, Tim Raines has a higher wins above replacement than Mike Schmidt, Tony Gwynn, and Dale Murphy, who won two MVPs. Raines hit .318, averaged 114 runs scored and 71 steals. During those 5 years, only Henderson scored more runs, only Wade Boggs had a better on-base percentage. Those two things are Hall of Fame statistics. Those two players were in the other league. There is no better player than Tim Raines that's not in the Hall of Fame. And one of those seasons, he had to sit out a month of the season, and he still averaged 71 steals. Without Ricky Henderson, Tim Raines is the best leadoff hitter of all time. The best. If you take Tony Gwynn's hits, subtract Tim Raines' hits, but add the walks, which is much more valuable today when we look at statistics than it ever has been before. He has more walks and hits than Tony Gwynn does. And Tony Gwynn was a first ballot Hall of Famer. And I don't agree with first ballot, second ballot. You either are in or you're not in. Tim Raines, there is no doubt that this man is in. And he should have been in a long time ago. I think the one thing that people hold against him, well, there are two things that people hold against him. One is the fact that he played so many years. If he had retired after 10, he probably would have been in anyway. That's number one. Number two, the fact that he had a cocaine addiction. So did Paul Molitor. He's in the Hall of Fame. You got to let go. And I think the fact that his nickname is Rock, unfortunately, is being held against him.
Sean, how long have you been waiting to make that argument?
I seriously think the fact that his nickname is the drug is being held against him. I absolutely believe that.
Oh no, I understand that. I'm just saying, as a whole, how long have you been waiting to yell to the stars about Tim Raines? You've been waiting to make that one for a long time. Nabate, your response is yours.
Now, I almost said Rock Raines. Tim Raines, okay. This was tough for me, too, because I talked to Seth about this, that this was really, really tough. The only problem with Tim Raines was that there was the factor that he did not do this for a longer period of time. That's the only thing. He was dominant for five seasons, yes, but you have to be able to have some longevity. You have to be able to, for example, like he made seven straight All-Star appearances and that was it. He didn't really dominate for the rest of the time, and pretty much through the late 80s and through the 90s, he was a pedestrian guy. He did get some stolen bases, but he was a pedestrian guy. Now, I give him credit that he did win a batting title in 86. He did. His on-base percentage was sensational, definitely in the early 80s, in the early part of the 80s decade. But I just feel that overall, though, he was not – for a longer period of time as dominant as like a Ricky Henderson that did it for a long time. And also Ricky was effective in his 30s. Tim Raines wasn't really as effective. But he did win a World Series with the Yankees in 96. Good veteran. Oh, I'm done?
No, I said 1 minute. You got your fine.
Oh, 1 minute. I'm sorry. Yeah, sorry. So, but like I said, it was really tough for me. Really tough. But I... Just doesn't get in for me.
Sean, 30-second response.
We go back and forth. Roy Halladay didn't do it for long enough, but did it for 7 years, and that was content. Tim Raines does it for 7 years and doesn't do it long enough. I'm kind of confused as to which standard we're using. Tim Raines encountered demons. They didn't happen to go down to the minors to do it. He went to jail. But he still had demons. Same concepts. I understand greatness. I do. I understand greatness for a brief period of time. I do. But he wasn't Don Sutton. Don Sutton was a guy that just accumulated. He wasn't Tommy John who just accumulated. He had
okay.
his brief period of greatness, and he accumulated.
John, 30 seconds.
First of all, I didn't say anything about his cocaine habit. I didn't say anything about that in debate, number one.
No,
and number
no,
two, I meant...
I was just comparing it to going down to the minors, just having... some demon. It wasn't necessarily. He was comparing it to the Halladay argument.
Oh, okay.
Halladay.
Well, but also too, like I mentioned before, Halladay won both his Cy Youngs 8 years apart. That's longevity. When you're dominant in between that time, that's what I was saying. Rock Rangers
right.
did it like six straight years.
Okay, we're down to our last two, and obviously we could go on for this for hours. But now we're on to hockey, and one of the more controversial players of all time. He was supposed to be the next Gretzky. He was closer to the next Brett Gretzky than Wayne Gretzky, but still a great player, a guy who single-handedly started the Colorado resurgence in 2000 by being traded from Colorado to Philly, where Colorado got Peter Forsberg and about 1,000 other things, hence the Herschel Walker trade of the NHL. That being said, Eric Lindros was one of the best players, one of the scariest players for a pretty significant period of time. Sean, you were in favor of him making the Hall of Fame. It's yours.
Well, we talk about dominance, and there was no more dominant player than Eric Lindros, even for a brief period of time. He had three consecutive 50-goal seasons. He was a 6'4 force. He tallied 41 goals and 75 points in 61 games in his first year. He followed up with a 97-point season. He edged out the Jaromir Jagr for the 1995 Hart Trophy. There is when you win the Hart Trophy, that's the most valuable player. That's where you are. He posted point per game numbers over his first nine NHL seasons, which I think only five or six other players have ever done. He entered with a bang and left with a concussion. But it doesn't really matter how he left. It's what he did while he was there. There was no more physically dominating force than Eric Lindros. Was he an ass? Yeah, he was an ass. But there are lots of asses in the Hall of Fame. And I don't think that should be held against him. It's what he did on the ice, not when he got hit. And I think most people remember the concept of all of his concussions rather than anything else. He was closer to Gretzky than he was closer to Brett Lindros. Brett Lindros only played 1 year.
Abate, your response.
Okay. What did he do in the playoffs? Did he lead his team? I mean, he did lead Philadelphia. I don't think he even led them to the Stanley Cup Finals, actually. He did.
No, he did.
He did. Oh, he did in 97, right. Okay.
Yep.
But other than that, what did he do to be a playoff force? Nothing, number one. For him to be that dominant. Lemieux, when we look at the players at that time, Lemieux, Sakic, Gretzky, all those players around that time period, Messier, those players, Cam Neely, Ray Bourque, et cetera, those players were able to repeatedly be, Brett Hull, repeatedly be able to dominate in playoff hockey. He disappeared a lot, except for that 1 year, number one. Number two, he was injured a lot. That's an issue. He had injury problems, and he did not dominate every single season like he should have dominated every single season. He only had he only was in the top 10 in points 3 seasons of his entire career because of the injuries. And also for goals, he was only in the top 10 in goals for only 4 seasons. And he did make 6 All-Star appearances. He did win an MVP, but he did not do it for a long period of time. That's what I look at for a Hall of Famer. A Hall of Famer to be consistently great every single season. Lindros was not that way. And also, as mentioned before, with the Quebec Nordiques, with him being traded from the Quebec Nordiques and the Avalanche being as great of a franchise that they became, it was because of that, because of Erik Lindros. And also, just in general, I just felt that he did not do enough overall for him to be a Hall of Famer in the NHL. Compared to all – and also remember, scoring was at a premium at his time where he was scoring. He didn't score 130 points at all. He only had 115. Did not score 130 or 140 points as the Lemieux and the Brett Hulls, et cetera, of his time. He was not a guy that was consistent enough like that.
Nabate, time up. Sean, 30 seconds.
All right. 3 real quick counterpoints. Cam Neely never made the Stanley Cup Finals. That's number one. Number two, Erik Lindros never played for the Quebec Nordiques. He got traded for 17,000 players just because he left the Quebec Nordiques, and those 17,000 players did better. Does that make Herschel Walker any worse of a player because he got traded for 17 draft choices to Dallas? No, he's still a good player. It has nothing to do with how the drafting does. And number three, he didn't play in the Stanley Cup playoffs. He did play. Only 2 teams make it the entire time, and it seemed like Mario Lemieux was in there the entire time, along with the Colorado Avalanche, who had a lot more talent than he did. So the fact that he didn't play to the degree that you want, he had injuries, so did Roy Halladay, so did Cam Neely, lots of players have injuries. He was dominant while he was on the ice.
Nabate?
But also, too, with Lindros, if you're supposed to be that great, you're supposed to carry a team like those great players did. You're supposed to carry them to the playoffs. You're supposed to carry them through. You're supposed to be that dominant. He was not that dominant overall. So, and like I said before with the injuries, I never really mentioned Halladay and his injuries. I never said anything about injuries to Roy Halladay, actually. So I don't know where that came from.
All right. Our last player. One of my all-time favorite goalie in the NHL. Played for 20 years, 2-time Stanley Cup winner with the Flames in 89, the Red Wings in 97. He used to play with him all the time in NHL 94, which is how I actually became such a big fan of him, sadly. Mike Vernon. Nabate? You're in favor.
Oh, okay, great. Yes. Mike Vernon. The reason why I have Mike Vernon winning 2 different Stanley Cups, and also winning the Smythe Trophy in 1997. In 97, he was 33 years old, pretty much supposed to be on the tail end of his career. He was able to lead the Detroit Red Wings to the Stanley Cup Finals, to a Stanley Cup Championship, coincidentally against Lindros and his Flyers. But he won 2 Stanley Cups when he was the dominating force at net for his team. And that was an 8-year period as well. I look at that because as a goaltender, championships means a lot to me if you're a goaltender. He also, as well, 5 All-Star appearances. The consistency as well, his longevity. He was able to have over 30 wins for 4 seasons in his career with Calgary. Now, Calgary wasn't that great of a team after they won their Stanley Cup in 1989. They started to fade, but he was still able to get wins and still able to have a good goals against average. And he had a goals against average in his career of I had the stat here. Hold on a second. He had a goals against average in his career of 2.98. And remember, he came up in an era where scoring was at a premium until the mid-90s when scoring started to go down, especially after the NHL lockout. And so you look at that. Overall, he was able to adapt with the times and be able to still, as he got older, be as dominant especially with the Detroit Red Wings. And of course, had a great career through his mid-30s with the San Jose Sharks as well, had a great season. And also, he did have – his record wasn't as great, but his goals against average was as consistent and one of the top – he was in the top 10 every season as well. And like I said, those two Stanley Cups in an eight-year span is major.
Sean?
One NHL All-Star team, second team. He did make five All-Star teams. Wins to me, not a goalie concept. It's a team concept. Better the team, the better the goalie. 385, he ranks number 12. What is a goalie concept entirely is the save percentage. His save percentage is 89.6%. That is very low. That's Jack Morris ERA stuff. And that is just keeping him out of the Hall of Fame. We talked about how a player who's a Hall of Famer should put a team on his back. Vernon just didn't do it. He won less than 50% of the games that he played in after that Stanley Cup. He won 23 out of 47, 31 out of 54, that's the only one, 24 out of 63, 29 out of 64. He just didn't do it. He's not a Hall of Famer. He's a very good defensive goalie who just couldn't make the saves. His top comp is Chris Osgood. Is Chris Osgood won Stanley Cups, too, with the same Red Wings. In fact, he split time with Mike Vernon. If you're going to put one in, you got to put the other one in. If you're going to put – I don't believe –
I think Osgood's a Hall of Famer.
I think Mike Vernon is the Andy Moog of the Detroit Red Wings. And there was no Grant Fuhr. So I don't think you can put either one of – I don't think Osgood goes in. And if Osgood doesn't go in, Vernon doesn't go in either. I understand the Vezina Trophy, he won one. So did Ron Hextall. Ron Hextall doesn't deserve to go in either.
But like I said, he won the Conn Smythe Trophy in 97. It's a team concept, but how did he win the Conn Smythe Trophy if that means that he was responsible for the Detroit Red Wings winning that title? He was responsible that season. And also his goals against, even though his winning percentage was below 50%, he still was in the top 10 in goals against average later in his career, even with the sub-500 record.
Sean,
last word. Won the Conn Smythe Trophy are Jean-Sébastien Giguère, Claude Lemieux, Bill Ranford, Ron Hextall, all guys that aren't going to, Bernie Parent, all guys that aren't going to make it. He won the Conn Smythe Trophy because you're right. He put the team on his back for the 16 playoff games that they played. You don't make the Hall of Fame based on one playoff season, because if he did, Don Larson would be in the Hall of Fame.
Wow.
Can I say your last word. Oh, okay. Well, in 89, he was 16-5 with a 2.26 goals against. He didn't do it just once. He did it twice and had 77 career wins in the playoffs.
Okay.
Sean,
if you want to say something else, Seth.
No, I think we're done.
Okay. Right. Yeah, because I had an extra point if you wanted to say it, too. That's fine. You know, so.
That was a pretty intense hour, guys. Just – for the record, my choices. Ward is out, Tasker in, Davis out, Brown in, Sikma out, Moncrief in, Jackson out, Reigns in, Halliday in, Lindros out, Vernon unfortunately out. So I pretty much split with both of you guys. I thought this was actually a really good show. And
yeah,
I want to thank Nabate Isles for coming on. I want to thank Sean Palmer for coming on. Nabate, any last words?
No, it was great. I had a good time. It was awesome.
Sean?
Happy New Year to one and all, and yeah, I got some things to say that I won't, because it's just all right there. We're in the New Year, so we're going to have good times.
Maybe we'll come back
wait,
for
what
part.
He, I'm sorry, I couldn't hear
good
what
times.
He said.
He
was saying good times. No, he was
saying
it was
a good time. I couldn't hear him.
Even more, thank you very much, Seth Kamens, for moderating this, where a moderator was definitely needed.
Guys, I hope we get to do this again. It was a blast. For Nabate Isles, so much to talk about on MNN on Wednesday nights. NBA Sirius Radio. Sean Palmer on the Seth and Sean Radio Show Tuesday nights, 7 o'clock on Blog Talk Radio. We'll do it again soon. Have a good afternoon. Have a good weekend, everybody.
Thank you, Seth. All right.